You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Before we get into this interview, a quick reminder about a live Comedian's Comedian special with Gary Delaney at the end of this very week. Sunday the 2nd of March at the Arena Theatre in Wolverhampton, Gary Delaney is going to do a set and then I'm going to interview him about the stuff he's just performed. That's this Sunday. So if you're in the Midlands, come along to that. It's going to be awesome. Now though, very excited about this one, another one live from the Edinburgh Festival in the Gilded Balloon. This is Missouri-born and now living in the UK, the utterly unique one-man sketch show that is Will Franken. Nice move. Will has deliberately walked on as slowly as possible. Thank you. You're kind. Hello, Will.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. Do feel free to take
Is it cool to do like Stephen Hawking at this thing? Hello, how are you doing today? It's good to see you.
that was an unbelievable impression.
It's weird. It's on a boom. I like it.
We were all about to be offended, and then that was actually very realistic.
Thank you.
Well done.
Cheers.
So welcome, Will. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
How is your Edinburgh experience going? How are you finding it? This is your second Fringe.
I find it to be the most amazing profit-making experience ever. I'm going to come away from this thing so loaded and without having spent a single dime of my own, and it's just amazing. Oh, the Fringe Festival.
Yeah.
Oh, no. It's really eating me. Oh, it's just, yeah.
Are you finding it expensive? How's your show going? Are you getting bums on seats?
I'm getting bums on seats, but it's the 5:40 time. It's hard for what I do. You know, last year was at 10:30 and this year I'm getting a lot of pedestrians.
Sure.
You know, Carol, there's a comedy show on, and then I don't want those people in my show. I want the drunk ones and the drug addicts and the prostitutes and the, you know, all that stuff. But
okay.
They're getting better, though. I mean, last week they've started to... And every time you get a crowd get you like that, you're like, okay, you've restored faith in my own insanity.
Yeah.
So... Yeah. Like that.
So let's just talk a little bit about what you do for the benefit of anyone here who hasn't seen you. What you do is, it's pretty much unique. I don't think I've seen anyone do an act like yours.
Structurally, it's Monty Python.
Okay.
You know, so when anybody says, what's your influence? It's the, when I was 14, I saw my first episode of Flying Circus out there in Missouri. And it used to come on at midnight. PBS would air it, the public broadcasting system. And there at midnight at 14 years old, I remember seeing an episode of Flying Circus and thinking that I wasn't alone in the world.
Yeah.
And it was something that the first joke I remember was they had an animation of the word hostile with an exclamation point, and there was a voiceover that said, hostile. And then when I saw how each little thing connected into the next,
sure.
I remember thinking, I want to do that. I've never done conventional stand-up. So first open mic I ever did at 16, it was like that. It was like one-man sketches that, you know, segued into others and had no beginning and end. And
that's it. I've never seen a one-man sketch show before. I've seen kind of one-man character shows, but you're using an incredible volume and density of characters and genres and accents and everything. And they do. They slide and segue beautifully into one another.
I appreciate it, yeah.
That's a style that you've... Have you encountered anyone else doing a similarly one-man version of that?
I haven't seen a live version of it. I think Mr. Show, if you're familiar with that...
Yeah, I know a little bit.
From the... late 90s, HBO. They did the same thing American style with two guys, but it was still televised. And I haven't seen it live myself.
Okay. But, so you've invented your own genre?
Oh, no, I don't want to say that. I get in trouble. Yeah, okay. No, you say that. I just do what I do, you know.
So when you were a 14-year-old growing up in Missouri, mm-hmm. were you kind of a weird kid? Did you feel that you were?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
And was ashamed of it. I always tried to be somebody I wasn't. I mean, for a deep person, I'm very shallow.
Okay.
And so I always tried to. I did an English accent when I was like 9 or 10, uh-huh. and I'd meet girls at school, and I'll pretend to be from a place called Cheltenhamshire, you know, and just talk like that. And my dad's a scientist, and you know, and then over the years, I found that, you know, you could lie doing characters, and you could avoid emotional intimacy.
Okay.
I've had some girlfriends where, like, the whole first date, I've been my friend from Cavan, you know, who's from Cavan, Ireland, and just talk like that for the whole date, you know, because I didn't really want to be with her, but she had a nice body.
Yeah.
Like that, you know, so. But, yeah, because the hardest character to play is yourself, you know. So, like, I remember as a kid, you know, like, you go on dates, they say, what do you do? Be yourself. And I had no conception of what that meant, you know.
Okay. So the idea of seeing mm-hmm. Python and kind of going, oh, there's other guys out there who are, what, idiots? Or that have, what was it? What element of it was that struck you, that attracted you?
Well, I knew there was something highbrow about it. Like, I remember, you know, at 14, I didn't get a reference to Kierkegaard. But I remember when Eric Idle would say, coming up next, it's Kierkegaard's Journals. And I would hear that, and I would know that I at least had to pretend to get it. Because the type of people I wanted to impress were always the smart ones, you know, which is a little bit snobbish, but... You know, I wanted people to think I knew what Kierkegaard was, because I knew that Python would go highbrow and lowbrow.
Yeah,
they had the everything but the kitchen sink approach,
sure.
which is like the character names have to be funny, the segues have to be funny. You can go real guttural, you can go real high, and there was a cell phone, and that is just not right. No, I have told you once, I have told you once again, and I've told you once a third time, and that's it. I'm not going to tell you once again.
That's okay. In the defense of those people, I was bullying them into sitting at the front at the yeah. time when I should have been saying, turn off your mobile.
Well, you should have sent them to the phone booth.
Yeah.
There's a phone booth here.
So the show that you're doing here, is mm-hmm. is that an original show that you've written for this festival?
I stole it all from a 16-year-old kid.
Or does it contain elements of previous work? Because I was looking at your website, mm-hmm. and I don't think I'd realized just the volume of material that you've produced.
Oh, cheers. Yeah.
So when we saw you do, I mean, I saw your show last year at the Fringe. Mm-hmm. That was your first
yeah, visit first Fringe, yeah.
to Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. What motivated that choice to come to Edinburgh?
Somebody paid for the whole thing.
Sweet.
I remember I was in New York doing the Fringe Festival out there, and for about 7 years, people said, you got to do the Edinburgh. Right. Edinburgh? I still can't say it.
Edinburgh.
And I remember there was a spread in the New York Times, and it was the picture of the Royal Mile, and I said, I'm never going to do that. It looked like hell with the, you know, somebody with the biggest an ego as I have. I mean, it's, you know, and then, God, what was it? Yeah, last year, somebody saw 5 minutes of my stuff, and this guy was an entertainment lawyer, but he did production as a hobby, like every Fringe, and... I remember he said he needed to check his account and then get back to me in 3 days. And I remember because I love the UK. I went out here in 07, and all my influences are British. So mm-hmm. to me, it was just like it was all a money issue. And I waited 3 miserable days for him to get back and say, yeah, we can cover the lodging and the airfare and all that. And,
yeah.
you know, I came out here, it was a big adventure because I'd never been to Scotland. And,
sure.
You know, I get to go to places like Drem. You know about Drem?
I've never heard of Drem.
It's a stop on the way to North Berwick. It's really station is Drem. You know, it's like a Middle Earth, you know. Really cool. But this year I've been living in the UK since February, and it's like you know, a lot of the day to day stuff, like, you know, people paying for gigs 3 months down the road, and, you know,
sure.
living off of Marks and Spencer cheese because I got a gift card, and
yeah.
Yeah, it's good cheese, but it gets old after a while. That's a tangent, man. I don't even know.
No,
where
that's
started
fine.
That.
We've got time for cool? tangents. That's okay.
Okay, right on.
So you, having come here to the festival last year, mm-hmm. you decided to stay effectively, and now you've moved permanently to the UK.
Yeah. I mean, I got to keep whipping out those 3 month visas, and then eventually go back to apply for full time. But I'm really down in the States, and I worry that Britain's. I'm very down on Sky TV. This isn't going to screw things up for you, is it?
No.
Because what I think made Britain great when it came to televised comedy was it had a limited number of channels. And so there was this notion that the cream must rise to the top.
Okay.
And I think with Sky TV coming in, it's going to be more of the internet reality TV. Britain's Got Talent. And it's, you know, I hope you guys don't forget what made you great. As far back as Swift and Chaucer, you know?
Sure.
I'm serious. I mean, I think one of the last great figureheads in satire was Chris Morris, and he's kind of in hiding right now. But
sure,
you know, you see something like The Day to Day, and it's just like,
it's mind blowing,
razor sharp, but also absurd. It's like, you know, just taking a knife to everything, but also keeping this like real surreal framework to everything. So,
sure,
you know, and I hope that tradition still continues out here. You know?
So, well, let's stay with your kind of your development as a comic from from that first moment when you were 14 to when you started to perform for other people.
Mm-hmm.
What were early gigs of yours like? What kind of environments were you doing them in? Even
first gig I ever did was a coffee shop when I was 16 with some. I had two mates, and we were all weird in our own way. But they wanted to be in a rock band, and I said, "We got to do a sketch troupe. Forget the rock band." I can say fuck the rock band, right?
Yeah, you can say that.
I got in trouble. Like, I was on Castle FM today, and I said shit. And then last year, they censored me because I said penis and vagina. what's an example of a bit? And I go, I play a vicar, and I marry a penis and a vagina. I'll say it. It's called dumping it.
Yeah.
So it's clinical terms. Because I feel like part of me is not going, well, you know, I fooled around sometime with comedy, and then I fucked around with comedy. So when I was 16, I did a coffee shop, and there must have been like 15 people in there, and I'm assuming 10 were friends of ours. And but it was like that. It was like a relay thing. Like three of us, you know, were doing a sketch, and then one would wind around. It was a Python framework. Mm-hmm. And then I think a couple of years after that, it was open mics, and I took a long time getting started. You know, mm-hmm. I made cassette tapes and sold them to friends, and did the occasional thing. But Springfield, Missouri, there wasn't.
Sure,
there was one open mic a week.
You were selling cassette tapes to your friends.
Yeah, I was teaching.
That's incredibly innovative, really.
Kind of. It was just me talking to myself as these characters. I got a 4-track recorder when I was a kid, and I just, you know, you come back in, you speed up the pitch, you get a woman's voice, you come back in over the top, you do a male voice, then you got four of you going at once.
I was going to ask that, actually. Yeah. I put something about one guy with a 4-track, because the material that's on your website, there's loads and loads of content, loads of MP3s. Some of them are clips from gigs, and others of them, mm-hmm. it's like you do a podcast as well, which mm-hmm. is, again, it's not like any other podcast I've heard. It's your own radio show.
Yeah, pretty much. They're like albums to me.
Yeah.
Like something that down the road I can smoke a joint and put on the headphones. And you know, I still do that, and I really like them. I just couldn't isolate, like... because I used to really, really isolate with comedy. You know,
how do you mean isolate?
Well, with those cassette tapes, for example, that was me just sitting in my room pretty much doing comedy as therapy. I didn't have a live setting. And then I would go do the open mics, and those were actually good. I mean, they were fun, but most of the time was spent just like talking to myself in a room, recording these things. And,
okay.
You know, and I liked them, but like now, the podcast I did for about 2 years, and I think the last one I did was, you know, maybe 3 years ago, and it's just hard to isolate like that anymore.
Gotcha.
That's why it, you know, as frustrating as the fringe is, it's great to be out among people and you know, talking in a live setting and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? And it's one of the, I was trying to have this conversation with my girlfriend about why I love going to festivals so much. Mm-hmm. Part of that reason is that as a comedian, you get to feel like a normal person because everyone else is a comedian.
Yeah.
And that's incredibly valuable. You might not realize how isolating it can be to be a performer and
excellent.
Spend a lot of time on the road in your car on your own. And I mean, it's quite an interesting sort of dynamic there, given that you're effectively a sketch performer, mm-hmm. but you're a potentially a lonely one. You've got all the work of the sketch groups, mm-hmm. but with the isolation of a stand-up.
Pretty much, yeah.
So when you kind of moved on, when did you first start hitting open mics, and what was that like if you were the only person on the bill doing what you were doing?
I say on the open mics, I did a regular one in Missouri for, you know, maybe 2021, and then I moved to New York when I was 24, mm-hmm. and I got so disheartened because, see, I'm a hayseed. Do you guys know Missouri at all? It's right in the middle of America, and it's hillbillies and white trash. And, you know, like, I was the first one in my family to go to college. I was the first one to, you know, my dad went to Vietnam, but that was not a trip or anything sure. like that. That was he had other work out there.
Okay.
and I went to New York, and the attitude was like, why would anybody move to New York? And, you know, I thought I was good. This is how naive I was. I thought I was going to go there and just do comedy on the streets, and somebody from NBC would walk by and give me a show.
Sure.
So I've always believed I was good at what I did.
Mm-hmm.
But 10 years down the road, it's just like the industry will keep kicking in the ass. And it's like, that's the challenge, is to say, no, the stuff is good. It's just that's confusing. But I know I got off track here. But I moved to New York with these ideas that I was going to, you know, perform a lot and get seen a lot. And it was so frustrating because you'd show up at an open mic and the queue would be around the block. And it was a lottery.
Yeah, okay. So you put the queue of other acts would be around the block.
Yeah. And then you'd finally, you'd go up like at 3 a.m. for two people. And I think I did that twice. And I was trying to be a good boy, you know, follow the rules. And, you know, coming from Missouri, we don't follow rules. There's an innate kind of working class, rage and stuff. So it's hard. No, that's how they do it here. That's how they do it. And I just, after I got into acting instead, I would get in like, I gave up on the open mic scene and did a lot of performance stuff in Greenwich Village and off-Broadway and stuff. Okay.
And when you say performance stuff, do you mean like being in other people's plays? Or still doing your own?
Mm-hmm. Did some voiceovers and taught in Harlem for a year. Uh-huh. And it was just absolutely insane.
What were you teaching? Teaching voice acting?
No, English and social studies. Oh, I see. Okay. 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. And because I didn't hate myself enough, I got a job with the inner city school system. And man, suck my dick, asshole. I'm the teacher, you know. Yeah. You send them down to the principal's office. They come back up 30 seconds later, and they go, "He said you got to deal with me." Okay, put a kid in a headlock. That was horrible. He deserved it. And it was funny because the first day I saw this 60-year-old teacher down the hall with a kid in a headlock.
Oh my god!
And I remember thinking, I'm just assuming that kid deserved it. I don't know. I can tell a story if you're interested.
Yeah, go on. Yeah, go for it.
Does this have anything to do with your question? I feel like I'm...
That's okay, but it's all right. We're building a picture of you.
No, you
that's
stop
okay.
me, because I could...
I'm enjoying it.
Okay, good.
I will. Trust me, I'll stop.
Well, I had a week...
Freewheel, and I'll pin you down when I want to.
Well, it's the great headlock story. I've been meaning to do it on stage for a while, but there was a kid who was, fucking around, and the one thing that they would do was read out loud. So they would, suck my dick, motherfucker, have it. And I go, all right, read. And Martin Luther King was my greatest hero, and then this one kid kept dropping his book on the floor, and he wouldn't go to the principal's office anymore because he realized that he didn't actually have to do anything that I told him to do. So, but for some reason, they always wanted to help. So if you said, "Would you go get me a broom from the janitor's closet?" He would leave. So he left, and I locked the door. And then he came back about 30 minutes later, and said, the kids were all, Frankie locked him out, Frankie locked him out, shut up, and then the kid came back. I was in the, they were starting to quiet down, and the kids whispering through the door, "Franken's a faggot. Suck my dick, Franken." Half of my mind is going, "Don't open the door. Ignore him." Yeah. The other half's going, "Open that fucking door and squeeze the fucking life out of me." And then it was really cool because all the kids ran out of the classroom, and they called for the principal. "Mr. Franken, go kill Dwayne." And then I remember seeing the principal's head. And it's in one fell swoop, I let go of the kid, turned around and pointed at him and said, "Okay, Buster, cool it. And then somebody, the other teachers got together and they said, "Look, if anybody complains, just say you were concerned about his safety." And the grandma complained, and I said, "I was concerned about his safety, basically." Yeah. And I was trying to restrain him from harming himself. Sure. And I have this thing where when I tell a lie, the back of my neck twitches because my head, my head was going, "Don't listen to me." I hope that was okay to tell that story.
Absolutely, yeah. Right. So, I want to come back in a moment to that development, how you ended up on the circuit you ended up on. Mm-hmm. But I think it's worth noting that your work has so many different characters in it, accents, voices, situations. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how much, you've had quite a varied life. Mm-hmm. That you see everything as a starting point for the work that you do.
Yeah.
Do you think that's true? Do you think you're kind of like almost like a vacuum of just sucking up experience and turning it into...
Yeah, usually like I'll do a character sometimes if I hate somebody. And I find that it's the best way to...
Okay.
Yeah, my ex-agent, who fired me because I asked for an advance for lodging. Am I allowed to talk about this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, but she had she reminded me of Eric Idle in drag. She'd do a lot of the, no, but yes, but no. And it was, kind of a, so if something perturbs me with somebody, I'll usually grasp onto that, and it'll find its way into something. And then sometimes I do it out of love too. Like, my mate Richie from Calvin, he's a great guy, but it's my way of sort of, carrying him with me wherever I go, my dad, he's in a lot of my stuff, in various manifestations, and it's weird because it is such a psychological working out of comedians are crazy people. Mm-hmm. Really, we're really damaged people, and that's what bothers me about the industry sometimes, is that the industry, we have an industry now in the entertainment industry that for the first time ever actually expects the comedians to be sane and normal.
Yes.
In other words, half businessman and half funny, and there really is no compromise.
Absolutely, there's a lot of there are a few comedians around I can think of that really don't fit into that mold at all. People like Ian Cognito.
I love him. We did a doubleheader at the...
It's just an amazing, amazing comic. But no part of him has got any sound business sense.
No.
It seems to me, you know.
And that's why he's so funny.
Yeah,
absolutely. I know it comes through that way. I know that's part of the reason, yeah.
Complete. That kind of wild nature of him is exactly why you want to go and see him.
Mm-hmm.
So, I take your point. I think it's interesting that now that's expected to be married to comedy as a career and as a career path and stuff like that. Well, let's just talk a bit more. So after your teaching experiences, how did you go from the acting world back into doing the circuit? Or did you do the circuit? Were you ever on mixed bill clubs? I don't know much about it.
You know what? I made $30,000 playing a French marquee for some .com company that went belly up.
Okay.
And I never had that much money in my life. And all I remember spending it on is chicken dumplings and CDs. I bought a CD a week back in the day when you had to buy music still. And then I bought a car. And it was too expensive to park it in New York, so then I moved to North Carolina because it sounded pretty. Moved in with a chick, and that was really horrible and did absolutely nothing. She was a lawyer, so we had nothing in common. Trophy girl, though. Real hot blonde chick. Real hot blonde chick with a shiny red car. And then we broke up, and I just took all my... I'd never been to San Francisco, and then I loaded up my car and just drove from one end of the country to the other and lived in my car for a couple of days. Okay. And I remember walking by... God, how old was I? I was 27. And I remember walking by a cafe in the middle of the day that said comedy open mic, and it was like an hour away. And I said, should I do this? Should I? I mean, really, that's how lazy and slow I was about this whole thing. So as bitter as I am about things, I mean, I took my fucking time, you know. Yeah. I was really scared. I was scared to make a lot of moves, you know. And so I ended up out there. It killed at the open mic, and the guy kept having me go back up and do more time. And within about a month, San Francisco was really good to me. It was like... Mm. I was getting paid 20-minute spots and stuff like that. And the best part was I felt like I was being rewarded for the weirdness, you know?
Yeah,
I was
absolutely.
Finally being seen. And
I mean, I don't know anything about the relative comedy scenes in San Francisco and New York now or at that time. Mm-hmm. But do you feel that San Francisco valued weirdness more as a city or with that particular club? Or what was it?
I think so, yeah. I think New York does too. L.A., I'm very anti-L.A.,
okay,
because it really is a city of just image, you know. Mm-hmm. And they do want that guy's got the right hairstyle. He's wearing the jacket that they wore on that thing, and it's really this meets this. And
sure.
You know, but San Francisco has its own character, and you can still make money there, you know, in the theaters and stuff. You know, putting on one man shows. New York doesn't have the money anymore, but it still does have the anti PC.
Okay,
have a little bit of an edge, you know. Although it is becoming more like LA, which is why I'm here.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and I don't want the UK to go down that
sure.
road. Yeah.
Do you think there's a danger that it might do? I mean,
yeah.
we've had people have started doing bringer shows in the UK in a way that was
horrible.
Never done. That's the thing that they used to do in New York, where in order, there's so many stand-up comedians who wanted to work that night for free, that not only would you work for free, you'd also have to bring two friends with you in order to get on the bill, in order to ensure that the club had an audience, which is a terrible way to run an industry, and it's sort of born of desperation and greed, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I haven't had telly in 25 years.
Okay.
And
you haven't owned a TV, you mean?
No, but every time I'm in a hotel, I turn it on, you know, fall asleep to it, and that gives me ideas, too. I mean, television, instant ideas, because it's all nonsense.
Sure.
You know? I like the new biscuits, you know? What? Who's talking to me? You wake up with that at 6 in the morning in your head, and it's just like... but I turned on, I hadn't watched TV since I've been out here. And I remember flipping through, I was in a hotel in Nottingham, and I'm flipping through the TV going, this is rubbish. What are they doing? I mean, Britain's Got Talent. What is this? It just seems like this cheap sentimentality.
Sure.
Has that always been here? It hasn't, has it?
We'll put that to the audience. Has it?
No.
Oh, this audience.
I think you're importing it from America.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's our rhetorical device, and it didn't work for me, and I hope you guys don't take it over here. It's like Oprah Winfrey, the whole...
Sure.
Tell me about when your child died, was that a sad moment?
Yeah.
Nah, it was because we had four others, so it was like, why not, you know?
So this is Will. I first saw him at Edinburgh in the Caves in 2012, and his opening number was him being an actor who was playing a butler who kept looking at a member of the audience and demanding they deliver their supposed next line, which of course they didn't know, which would be the next cue for his line. That sounds weird to explain. It was even weirder to watch. It was absolutely brilliant. It was around midnight, and this mind-bending premise was just absolutely captivating. I love the rest of the show. I'm pleased to say he's going up again this year. Do catch Will Franken if you can. He's obviously completely unique. Just listen to him. Loads of interesting stuff from him here as well. We'll get right back to that in just a second. Now, I'm releasing an interview with Tim Vine next week. That's another one from the Gilded Balloon at last year's Edinburgh Fringe. And the week after that, we're going to release the Gary Delaney interview that I'm recording this very Sunday at the Arena Theatre in Wolverhampton. There's still tickets available for that one, and it's going to include a performance from Gary as well. It's a proper live special like we did with Acaster and Benny Boot. He's just an incredible joke writer and performer. You'll all know who Gary Delaney is. If you're a comedy fan, he's just... most of the jokes that you've ever heard were written by Gary Delaney. I think that's probably fair. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of punchlines. And we're going to get stuck into what makes him tick and exactly how he creates all of that lovely gear. That's this Sunday, 2nd of March. Tickets are available from the Arena Theatre Wolverhampton's website or through the ComCom Facebook group, which I'm pleased to say has just passed 1,000 members. So thanks everyone for joining that. I'm losing my place here in my little notes. And I can't stop because I've got too much on, so I'll bash through. Remember, you can join that to get advance warning on little odds and sods. I generally release details on live shows on the mailing list first, then the Facebook group, and then on @ComComPod on Twitter. And I try to stagger it so that you want to be on one or another of those. But I'm probably fooling myself that you're all glued to your computers, desperate to find out when the next thing happens. All of the details for those are available at www.comedianscomedian.com. And that's also where you can leave a PayPal donation if you'd like to. Thanks, as ever, for those. If you'd like to email me, you can do that, info@comedianscomedian.com. And I've had so many warm and encouraging and inspiring emails, I'm probably due a wanker. So if you want to write it and slag off the show... I mean, that'd make a nice change in some ways. Thank you, all of you who've been emailing me and saying really nice things. Much appreciated. Anyway, thanks for listening. Do keep telling your friends about it. I feel like the ball's kind of rolling now, and every day I see more and more people recommending it to their friends on Twitter. That's very positive to see, so thank you all. Now, let's get back to Will Franken.
So you're in San Francisco. You found you felt like you'd found a place where your weirdness was being embraced.
Yeah.
So what was the kind of trajectory there? Were you doing kind of bigger, longer bills? Were you traveling as a comedian? Did you go on a circuit? What was your situation?
No, I never had the traveling thing until I came out here. I had a home theater, and then I would have a fan base that would come back to that theater on a monthly basis. I did a little bit of traveling.
God, that sounds brilliant.
It was fun.
They'd come back to see you.
Yeah. Although what sucks is you can't make friends with your fans, you know, and I would do that. And I'm one of these people that would just be, hey, I always ask what somebody's name is. I really loved your show. Oh, thanks. What's your name? You know, because it is weird to go like, because there's that working class side of me that's like, I didn't do anything. I just did some funny voices. I didn't actually build a house, you know.
Sure.
But please remind me. Bring me back. I just got totally derailed there.
No, that's fun. That's fascinating. I was talking about having your own, having the difference between having a venue. That
well,
I think
is
what all comedians want, is to be able to have their own venue that people come to see them, certainly in the UK, and not need to hack up and down motorways every night.
Well, I love the hacking up and down. What was great about that, though, was it did force me, like, every month. It was kind of like a mini Fringe, because I would do an hour and a half show, and I would write a brand new 90 minutes.
What?
Every month, and I would title the show, because that's how I made my money. That's how I paid my rent.
Okay.
So I would say, what's the title of the show? And it'd be like, what was one of them? Grandpa, It's Not Fitting.
Sure.
You know, this weird line would come to me, and then about 2 weeks before, I'd be like, holy shit, I gotta write a show. And, you know, all the marketing.
So you'd write 90 minutes of material in 2 weeks. And then would you do it once, or would you do like a run of that?
Yeah, it was a one-off. I did two runs.
But this is insane, though.
Yeah.
So unusual. Okay.
Yeah. It is very unusual. It was bad marketing strategy, I think. I mean, I had that fan base that came back.
Sure.
And it was a nice shot of cash, you know, once a month. Okay. It would be your money for rent. And
well, let's look at the writing process. How do you come up with 90 minutes of material in 2 weeks? How do you what were any of the starting points, the processes that you used to do that?
Jeez, that's a tough one. And I know this is the most important question.
Mm-hmm.
I never write anything down.
Okay.
What I do is an idea comes to me. And I talk it out in the voice over and over and over until it sticks.
In a room on your own?
Yeah, and that's hard to find.
Yeah.
You know, out here, it's because it's so mad, I feel like I can walk around and talk to myself openly, but I am paranoid about people looking at me.
Okay, and, so to work on material, you'd have the idea, you'd go for a walk somewhere near your house, and just be talking out loud to yourself, working the stuff out.
Mm-hmm. Like the cabbie that I did.
I'm so glad to hear this, because a couple of days ago on this show, one act, I can't remember who, I think it was Andrew Maxwell, was basically having a go at me for having tried something similar myself. Yeah, he just thought that was preposterous. So no, I'm thrilled to hear that someone else has done it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because if you write something down, you create two yous. There's the real you and the written you. Okay. And that's why people have a hard time memorizing their own stuff. And I never could understand when people say, how do you memorize it? And I said, it should be easy because it's your own stuff, mm-hmm. right? Like the cabbie. I took a cab. My first week in London, I took a cab back to Ealing. It was 50 quid, but it was worth it because I got a good character.
Yeah.
And I was talking to the guy about going to France. I said, well, I got to go to France in May.
Have you been to France before, sir? The French are the most atrocious, shitty people on the face of God's green earth. They are shit one and all, sir. And he just talked like that the whole fucking ride about France. And they were shit.
And then, so that was the reality, was him just going after the French. So yeah. When I went home that night, I had his voice stuck in my head. Yeah. So I stayed up to about 3 going,
they are shit one and all, sir. A lot of shit, sir. And I just felt the face and the voice, and it felt really nice to talk like that.
And then I wrote myself in as a character, reacting to him. Then I had to give it a situation. I knew that I can't just go out and just do that voice beyond, 2 minutes and mm-hmm. expect it. You know, well, it's nice you did the voice, but what else are you going to? So I had to write a storyline to it. And as I kept talking, I don't know how I came up with this, but it was at one point he says the Muslims, we go off on the Muslims. And I say, he says,
I should have picked up a phrase book when I went to France, sir. Learned how to speak things in French. Like, listen, you snobby French cunt. I said, speak English.
And I say to him, I know, I wish they still spoke English in London because, I live in this neighborhood and they got a lot of, I'm leading towards. And he goes,
now, the Muslims are wonderful people. They're the most accepting, tolerant people on the face of Allah's green earth, sir. They are wonderful. They are staunch advocates for freedom of speech and expression. Never had a bad.
And the fact that he's so sarcastic, he's not sarcastic, but, yeah. but the bit is sarcastic.
Sure.
It's saying, and I'm trying to draw something out saying, well, it's perfectly fine to talk shit about the French, but you cannot go down this road at all. And, and in order to do that, I've got this gormless cab. That's kind of wrote the material for me. So his voice got implanted in my head.
Okay.
And then I don't write it down at all. I just rehearse and rehearse. I get in the shower and I talk to him. The shower is a great place. I will waste a lot of water. I would just stand there.
Would that be all, sir? They all shit one and all, sir.
And then once it's there and it's locked in, then I just write down in a bigger show, like an hour show, I just write down cabbie, 4 minutes.
Yeah.
And then that's it. Because the moment I write it down, I feel like I've gone from something organic to something artificial.
Okay.
So it doesn't sound stilted. And there's only 3 pieces I've ever written where I did actually want a stilted effect to the delivery, which is, one is the British Telecom. Thank you for calling British Telecom. My name is Ahmed Vishnu. In what capacities might I engage a triumvirate of my mind, body, and spirit in such configurations where in service to the customer will fully be actualized? And I had to type that out. I had to get that. Because he takes 2 minutes to ask what the guy's name is.
Yeah, okay.
Because I love the way the Indians use a very eloquent 18th century style of English. It's true. They really know how to use the language. And so that I wanted some sort of like almost stilted Joycean type language.
Okay.
But rarely. Usually it's just organic talking to myself.
Okay.
Until it sticks like a sponge,
And so when you were ending up with 90 minutes worth of that material, all of those different characters, what decisions were you making as to the structure of the show? What kind of decisions did you make as to what would begin and end it, or how the segues would work? Because that's another feature of your work, much like, have you seen the Pajama Men?
Oh, love
you know
them.
Those guys? Yeah, great. I mean, they're almost a sort of a similar sort of work to you, but between the two of them.
Absolutely, yeah.
And all three of you really segue in between different characters and situations very, very smoothly. So how do those happen? Is that you in a room on your own marking through the show or what?
Well, like sometimes a bit will come to me. My average bit, like when I say bit, that could be up to 5 to 10 voices in a bit. So whatever the bit or vignette is, my average is 2 to 3 minutes. But every now and then I'll have a character that's like 5 to 8. So if something comes to me like that, I go, it's either a closer or an opener.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times I'll write a show and I'll write, whatever the name of the closer is, and then whatever the name of the beginning is.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'll just have a middle and I'll write it out vertically. Like, it's all got to go towards this end.
Mm-hmm.
Like the bit that I did have was, I had the Peckham Fire Brigade.
Yeah, right.
You know that one with the Peckham Fire Brigade? Yes, I see. At this very moment, 4 children are trapped in a house, and he gives a speech to the firefighters, which, of course, takes 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Before we leave here, what does it mean to be a firefighter? As you make your way to 49 Banham Road, take time to ask yourselves, who will save the children? Of course, the phone rings again. It's like, yes, I see him. It appears that great behemoth Time has once more got the better of us. The children have perished. But that's something that comes to me. I go, well, that's obviously a closer.
Yeah.
So stick it down at the end, and There's all sorts of tempo things too, like what I like to do is go, and then just Joyce kind of did it with Portrait of the Artist. Portrait of the Artist, as a young man leading up to Ulysses, he was going straight narrative into that, into Finnegan's Wake. And so, does that make any sense?
Yeah, like, a little bit. I haven't read any of those books, but
so you told me you were going to read that before the interview.
Yeah.
I said, read all your Joyce.
I'm aware of some of those things. I know that.
Yeah. Finnegan's Wake's like a mantra that you have to read out loud. But
yes, that's the one. Yeah.
But the whole thing is like I like to go from a speedy tempo to a slow tempo. Or there was one time I took, I don't know how many bits I had, but what I did was I cut each bit in half. So let's say like I had a football coach who was 3 minutes. I would cut him in half and move the first part here and then the second part there. Then the next bit I was going to do, which connected to the coach, I would cut that in half. And so the whole effect I was going for was like one of the Russian nesting dolls, which I love those as a kid, man. I just so, like, the smaller they got, the macrocosm, microcosm. And so the whole show was basically we're going inward and then we're going outward again.
That's the book Cloud Atlas does the same thing. I'm just keen to.
It does.
I'm keen to prove that I've got, I have read a book.
My Lord.
But it does, yeah. Then the movie as well. It's a really sort of fascinating technique where you rush towards something and then out the other side.
Yeah. And it's just layer with
so
layer.
So what motivated that sort of a decision? Is it just that you're sort of wanting to explore and play with the different shapes mm-hmm. you can make your work?
Yeah. There's that. And then there's also like, as far as content, I did one show in San Francisco. What was great about San Francisco was much more than the UK, they were cool with having the piss taken out of the PC culture. And they're very PC out there.
Sure.
And I'm one of those – comedians are very anti-authoritarian by nature. So if you tell me not to say a word, I'm really going to find a way to say that word.
Yeah.
You know? And I remember the show I did before I left there was just really – it was like all of the PC cows. Hmm. And I stacked them in order from – I began with an abortion doctor, mm-hmm. and then, you know, which to me was just black humor, you know, just dark humor. And then I just gradually worked my way down. And then the very ending bit, which I rarely do a lot of tech anymore, which was a stewardess giving announcements on how to prepare, you know, in case of an emergency. And I replaced all the stuff with Islamic stuff. So instead of safety card, I would pull up the Quran and strap the seatbelts on. I had this bomb I'd made out of clay and wires. And the whole joke was the guy wasn't even Arab. So it's okay. I'm a University of Middle Eastern Studies. And he's just this American that it can't blow up the plane because it's crashing.
Sure.
So that you can hear the sound effects of the plane taking off. Something goes wrong. It's going down. And he's really frustrated. And he's like, what am I going to do? He's miming like the, you know, I packed the bomb. If this plane goes down, could you say it was because of America? And the whole joke was to move from what I saw in San Francisco is the least offensive to the most offensive. Like what are the biggest PC cows and go in that order.
Okay.
Also sex too. I like to close my shows with the one I'm doing now, like has the penultimate bit is really sexy. Mm-hmm. It's a sexual harassment counselor who harasses his audience as they're, as he's talking about sexual harassment. And it's exciting for me because I get to that point in the show where I'm feeling kind of, you know, horny, you know, and it's nice. And, you know, so, but I have all sorts of reasons, personal or structural or,
okay. So with some of that stuff about the political correctness stuff, do you ever run into problems with audiences that maybe don't read it in the same way that you?
Oh, yeah. I had a girl tweet, you know, that's why you should never search your name on Twitter. There was a girl that said it was the most misogynistic, anti-LGBT, anti-disabled show I'd ever seen. And I was about to write, "You forgot racist." Which it's not, of course, but I want it to be. Sorry, it's this new religion, you know. And I always think the ancient Jews couldn't say Yahweh, or they get mm-hmm. stoned to death. And I think we live in a day and age now where there's all these words that actually creates a bigger distance between people. You know, I'm a libertarian, which is freedom of speech at any cost. I mean, good speech, bad speech, or whatever. And I think too many people censor themselves, and because of that, we live in a sort of this mundane illusion of we're all one people. When we're not. I mean, the reality is we should be able to just to talk directly. It's 2013. Mm-hmm. And so when I read that, I thought, you know, first off, how can anybody be anti-disabled? You know, because the bit that she was referring to wasn't even about that. It was an absurd bit that there's a guy with cerebral palsy who loses out to Daniel Day-Lewis for a character who has cerebral palsy.
Okay.
And that's the whole bit. And it's a commentary on the insincerity and inauthenticity of the media age.
Sure.
That is my big enemy, is the media age.
And do you think then that because, I mean, there's already, just when you did that in a kind of cerebral palsy mm-hmm. voice there, you mm-hmm. can immediately feel the tension in a room, certainly in the UK.
I felt a lot of hatred, yeah.
Yeah. But when you go on to explain that that's what the bit's about, there's a certain amount of, okay, fine, this person isn't actually a monster.
Yeah.
Do you think that you... What am I trying to ask? Do you think it's only okay to do that kind of voice if you're using it as a piece of satire? Or mm-hmm. do you just think that anything is allowed, anything's fair game to...
I think anything's allowed. The only time I get offended is intellectually. So if somebody's going up there and doing something that doesn't have any intellect or cleverness behind it. But to explain a bit, like I had there was one day I had a 1:38 gig in the afternoon. And I wanted to do that bit because it's a nice 3-minute bit. Mm. And it's easy, and you don't need any props. But for some reason, I felt like I needed to just go, okay, this is a bit that somebody said was anti-disabled. And I never do that. Mm. Because, you know, if you see Chris Morris's Brass Eye special about the pedophilia, mm-hmm. it's obvious he's not a pedophile. It's obvious he's not advocating pedophilia. It's obvious he's going after an angle of the pedophile story, which is like the sort of... you know, the hyperactivity, the media, all that stuff. And that's what he's going after. So he wouldn't take time to stop and say, before I do this show. And the thing is, with my audiences, I always give them a lot of credit. I never assume my audiences are stupid. And I never want to talk down to them and say, before I do this bit, I should warn you, there's going to be some dirty words in there. Now, I know you guys are all adults. Because that's what I feel about multiculturalism and PC as a doctrine, like coming from San Francisco and having done the academic route for a while. You know, I taught college for a while, and I remember hearing this stuff and just thinking this is going to be such a stricture on free speech, and it's going to make the illusion stronger, but it's going to restrain us artistically, you know, if we can't have freedom of speech, choice, or thought in what we do. And I think there's a lot of people that come in that would like it if I talked down to them. That would say, I know you're adults, and I know you all have a sense of humor, but I'm going to actually talk down to you and explain this. I don't feel that's the role. I think that the role is that we both aspire upwards. We elevate the discourse. So if I do a bit that's obviously not about, you know, I've seen people go up and talk. If I was Scottish, I've seen some comedians go up here that I would be offended if I was a Scot, because the whole act is, you Scottish people drink a lot. I mean, I drink a lot, but the Scottish people drink a lot. Mm. And I would be offended. It's like, that's all you got to say? Have you been to Scotland before? What do you know about this country? You come over here and you just latch onto that one thing. So that, to me, I would get offended there because there's no cleverness behind it. It's not saying anything profound or whatever. So does that sound pompous? I know you said it's cool to be pretentious here.
Do you find it hard to fit into the industry given that what you do is so different?
A bit, yeah, but it's better out here. Okay. Like out here, I've had more industry offers just in the short time that I've been here than I would have ever had in the States, because there's no character comedy tradition out there. Mm-hmm. The characters we do have, like Larry the Cable Guy, but he still does stand up. He puts on the overalls, he chews tobacco, but he's
basically a stand up.
He's a stand up, yeah.
Okay.
And I think there is still this desire in Britain for character comedy. So when I came out here, my first feeling was like it was long overdue. You know, and everything about moving to a different country is so intimidating. It's like, no, you can't. I mean, if it was hard for me to move to New York as from Missouri, it was even harder to come to the UK, because this is the ultimate fantasy. You know, I saw this interview with John Lennon. They were going to deport him, remember, in the mid-70s. And they said, why do you want to stay if they want you out? He goes, because this is where the music comes from. And to me, this is where the comedy comes from. I mean, I am, as you know, no matter what the state of comedy here now is, I'm in this country where the Goons and Milligan and Q and Monty Python and all this stuff came out of, you know.
Have you been keeping up with British comedy since those moments of inspiration in your youth?
Yeah, up to maybe up to Mighty Boosh.
Okay,
that's not that current, but yeah.
Sure, yeah.
I do get a little nervous about watching current things because I always like to stay like, you know, and it's ritualistic and it's neurotic, but I do like to stay a little bit ignorant of what's going on at the moment. Yeah.
Okay.
But Boosh,
like
I love
Joey
Boosh.
Ramone not listening to any other guitar music sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah, like yeah. that. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Just you kind of stay immune from any being influenced. Because I remember seeing Mighty Boosh. I nearly wet myself on the on the plane, but I just thought it was the one with the, you guys know it, with the bubble gum, the vacuum cleaner.
I don't remember that.
It was so surreal.
I'm remember, familiar with the show, yeah.
Yeah, and then I got depressed because what will happen is I'll laugh and I'll go, oh, God, it's all over for me.
Yeah.
I just assume that there can't be two surreal people out there.
Sure.
Because it is rare nowadays. It's a rarity nowadays.
Yeah.
But, and I'm surprised there hasn't been a Python repeat here. But I remember reading the Python interviews and Cleese said that what happened was they were kind of a victim of their own success because nobody would do anything. Everybody was afraid to do anything that was even slightly like Python because they would be afraid of people saying you're trying to do Python.
Sure.
Fry and Laurie did a few things like that, but there hasn't been, you know, there's the Q debate, whether Q was the forerunner. But, but
when
that
you,
kind of...
Sorry to interrupt.
No.
When you talk about seeing other stars, I mean, that's something I, and I'm sure a lot of other comedians can relate to, is seeing someone else be brilliant and going, oh, God, what's the point?
Oh,
or,
you know.
Do you suffer from, I mean, you mentioned getting depressed from it. Mm-hmm. Do you suffer from any kind of worries or problems or depression based on the nature of this industry? This is a particular kind of topic of mine because I'm suffer phenomenally from anxiety of work related stuff. Yeah, terribly. Yeah,
yeah. I've had a lot of heartbreaks. You know, I took two of my podcasts down because I named people by name because you do expect them to be human and they're not. And if you can accept that they're not human, you know, I know this sounds really bleak and serial killer.
Who do you mean? Would you expect what partners? You expect partners to be human?
I'm talking about
human.
Industry.
Industry people.
You expect
I
the industry.
To, I see.
Yeah, you expect them to be your friend.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't make that decision. You can't make that assumption.
So you've named industry people, and then
from years
they've been
ago,
angry about
from
it
years ago. Because I had there was an agent in New York, and I was always trying to get an agent because I always thought once I get an agent, then I'll have that filter to be seen. And my friend John Colleary, you know him from Dublin?
I don't know.
Great stand-up.
Okay.
And real good guy, real good Irishman. And he says, we live in this day where the industry is no longer a filter. Mm-hmm. It actually wants to be creative. And that's a problem. And see, back in the day, they knew their place. We are just the people that have the means to get this heard. And now they want to go, what you should try to do is try to, but what, wear a little red wig or something like that. And then and immediately their hands are involved and the art is gone. Python went to the BBC. I love this. The BBC exec came to the guys at Python. They didn't know what the hell they were doing. They were going to call it Flying Circus. Nobody knew what it was. But the BBC exec came in and said, we here at the BBC like to stay one step ahead of public opinion. And that is such an anti-American approach, but the idea that we're going to stay one step ahead of public opinion, thereby we're going to shape it.
Yeah,
we're going to bring them something different. I don't think they'd have that nowadays. I think too many people would get involved and muck it up somehow. So the thing that really depressed me about that was I remember somebody one time read an interview that an agent from LA had given, saying what they're looking for, and they said some of the most depressing words I've ever heard. They said, talent only plays a small part. What we're really looking for is somebody who's a good guy to hang out with. And I thought, I'm fucked. I'm a good guy to hang out with, but I have to like the people I hang out with.
Yeah.
You know, that's the problem.
Sure.
That's why a lot of people from LA I just don't like. I have friends down there, but if it's like they're a salesman, I can't fake it. I would rather be smoking by myself, having a beer, watching an old movie. You know, life's too short. And I've never been good at that. Right, okay, so you're with so-and-so. It's a totally different mindset. And I blame the working class aspect on that sometimes. And then other times I realize I'm just happier not getting too much into that. If they want to work with me, that's fine. But just don't pin your hopes too much on it. The beauty is the live shows. The beauty is, as frustrating as this festival can be sometimes, the beauty is doing those random slots. You know, or doing something like this, or getting on and doing 10 minutes at some bar in the middle of nowhere, and that's the rock and roll part of it, and that's the thing I forget a lot.
Are you hoping that the move to the UK will result in, I mean, or is it kind of it's an escape from those sort of producer led things? Are you?
Yeah.
Okay.
See, what I want is very simple, and last year I got an agent, and I was 10 years I've been trying to get an agent, and I finally get one, and it's like, you know, it was real quick. It was like, Right. You know, and this year, you know, I'm talking to people, but I'm much more honest this time. Last year, I was a little scared, and I was like, "Don't mess it up. You might have an agent." You know, and it's like it's like with women. You know, and no offense, but you know, as a man, no matter how much we say we've progressed, you still have to pretend that you're not that interested. You know, and it's hard when you're really interested and you think, oh my gosh, this pretty agent wants to work with me. My gosh, see, Dad was wrong. I am important, you know, and all this psychological stuff comes to the fore. And this year, I'm just really clear with what I want. See, last year, they were, because they're thinking film and TV. I want to be on film and TV. I would love to be on film and TV. Chris Morris did some wonderful things with TV. And for some reason, he got to do it his own way, which is a rarity. I mean, complete creative control. That's brilliant. But this year, when I'm meeting with people, I'm saying, you know what, the most important thing for me is to stay in this country and do those little gigs out in Neath or Beckles or Lowestoft or wherever that is.
It's because delightful to hear those words in your accent.
I love those places, man. I love it. And then when you make a group of strangers, like a group of 40 out in the middle of nowhere laughing, you get $100 and you can go off and buy a pork pie and a can of Stella. To me, that's it. That's all I want. And I know I'm aiming low. I know I'm really aiming low. But I like that. You know, I like the people I meet. And the, you know, I got to get a car because the train gets rubbishy after a while. But that's it. That's all I want. I get to do my weirdness in front of people. You know?
It's very brave. I can certainly relate to those meetings with industry people where you're thinking to yourself, I've got to say something to impress this person. Mm-hmm. And then coming to it years later and thinking, no, what I have to say is actually what I want.
What you want.
And if that's actually what they want, then it's going to work. Mm-hmm. And if it isn't, then I'm going to be trapped in some...
How many times have you had a girlfriend and it's the same story? You didn't tell her what you wanted? And
I always tell them what I want.
You do? No, I never can. I'm too... I'm British in that regard.
Would it be possible, maybe just one day, if you possibly, just if you could take your clothes off one day. I mean, that's all. I mean, nothing, I don't have to do anything, just take clothes off.
Good call, I am a bit like that, okay? we've got just sort of 5 minutes or so before we wrap up. If it's all right with Will, I know, man.
This is so fun, man.
No, thanks, thank you.
God, it's cool.
I think we should give you the opportunity to ask questions if anyone would like to ask any questions.
Sure.
That one over here? Yeah, go for it. Okay, it's a good question. So how much does the weirdness drive you and how much do you drive the weirdness? And is there ever the case that it can go too far?
I think it goes too far when you forget, when you get wrapped up in just the structure. When you're just trying to like razzle dazzle with, and then a clever segue or whatever. But I think if you forget the comedy, it can go too far. Like when people tell me something's interesting, I hate that. It's like, but how many times did you laugh? Because at the end of the day, I'm a comedian, you know, and it's about, we have to have our ears fucked by laughter so often or father was right. It's just weird. To me, it's very primal, you know? So, but I think the weirdness is always there. You know, I felt very isolated and weird as a kid, and I think it was just a natural outpour. I had a friend when I was 14, and I used to make weird words by myself. I used to love to look in the mirror and go, schnacka. You know, that's the kind of shit I would do to entertain myself, to pass the time. And I remember we had a painting class with this kid, and he was doing that too. And we became best friends, and I remember I just asked him, like, are you weird too? And that was the only thing. I was like, you're a weirdo too. It's amazing. And I thought I was the only one. And then when I read Beckett and Monty Python and Frank Zappa, it was like, this can be done, you know? So
do you think there's, obviously you're doing your stuff because you're expressing yourself, you're recognizing, you're celebrating your own weirdness. Mm-hmm. Does that have a healing effect? This is a favorite question of mine. Do you think it's helping that you're expressing it and getting it out there? Does it help you resolve the issues with wanting to impress Dad?
Mm. I think as long as your motivations are clear, that everything's like, it's okay. Like we talked about the industry tonight. Like if I put any hope in the industry or start thinking in terms of money or whatever, I forget, you know, Jerry Maguire, you guys seen Jerry Maguire? Brilliant movie. I mean, I know it's mainstream, but it's when he says, I want to take you back to that little kid who first played football. It wasn't just about the money, was it? Hmm. And there was a good 2 years there where I forgot what it was about, and it was about the money and like, oh, this guy got that, but where's my thing on the poster and this shit like that. So when I do The Fringe now, it's just like I go up, I show up, and I'm really glad when people dig what I do, you know, because it does feel like I connected to something. And then and in that sense, when you meet a fan who shows that he appreciates you and appreciates your madness and all that stuff, it does kind of nullify that those childhood fears, you know, that you weren't quite fitting in somehow, or, you know, you weren't doing the ordinary thing. And then in that sense, it does pay off. When you realize you're not alone in your madness and that an audience connects with you, then that's what it's all about. And it does nullify that pain.
That's a great answer. That's a great answer. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Will Franken.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
So that was Will. Gigged with him just the other night, in fact, at Damien Larkin's gig in Stoke, and it was excellent to see his, you know, pretty weird and esoteric stuff just smashing it on a Saturday night club environment. It obviously a great gig for him, but it also made me respect the otherwise very straight-seeming audience, really, for letting themselves get caught up in Will's very finely tuned brand of madness. He's been doing it for a while now, hasn't he? And he's obviously, he's not just a weirdo, he is very good at taking people with him, which I think some comics who do more odd, unusual sort of stuff, it can, you know, sometimes feel like they're lost in their own world. Will very definitely in his own world, but very, very adept at drawing you into it as well. So do catch him if you can. Check out his website, willfranken.com. There's loads of links there to his own podcasts, long-form sketch recordings, loads of audio, and he's got bundles of stuff on YouTube, so fill your boots. Thanks very much to Pete Jones, James Lowy, and Ben Lund-Condlin. As ever, this show was co-produced by Nathan Wood. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. I'll speak to you next week with Punnery Sergeant Major Tim Vine. See ya!